Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to another edition of CMC Radio. I'm your host, Rob May. I hope everyone's having a good week so far. It is Tuesday, 7 a.m. here on the East Coast in New York, and very excited to have on the show with me today Dr. Nigel Robb out of the UK. Nigel, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
And so now, Nigel, where exactly are you located today?
I am based in Bristol, and I'm in one of the peripheral hospitals where we run some clinics.
Very nice. And so what is exactly that your specialty is?
My specialty is in pain and anxiety control for dentistry, particularly the pharmacological side, so local anesthesia and sedation.
And so what kind of goes into that? I mean, as far as pain management, why is that, so important in dentistry?
Well, because most of the treatments that we inherently have to perform on patients would be extremely painful for the patient to undergo if we didn't have some way of dealing with that. For example, doing a filling or doing an extraction, taking a tooth out, would be an extremely painful procedure for the patient.
And now, is it a combination of, medication, or, is there anesthesia that you have to administer?
Well, the main medication we use for pain control is the local anesthetic, the injection in the gum that anyone who's been to the dentist for treatment will be well used to, been around for about 111 years now in various forms. So that's the foundation of our pain control. The main skill with it is actually using it appropriately to get each individual patient absolutely pain-free for their dental treatment.
Right. And so just to kind of take us back a little bit, how is it that you got involved in this? What was it about dentistry and pain management, really, that kind of sparked your interest?
Well, I originally got involved in dentistry, something I'd always wanted to do from about the age of 12. I think largely because of the fact that I had a very good dentist when I was a child, who was very caring, very good in terms of his patient management, and I guess was a kind of role model that I wanted to aspire to. Personally, I'd never had any problems receiving dental treatment, wasn't at all scared, apprehensive, had a lot of treatment as a child. I think it's no secret that I was born and brought up in Scotland in the 1960s, where the dental health was quite appalling. Diets that were high in sugar, oral hygiene that wasn't the greatest. So by the time I reached adulthood, I'd had a lot of dental treatment, but no problems. But then after I got into dentistry, I realized that a lot of people have significant issues accepting dental treatment, particularly in the United Kingdom. I think it's about 46% of the population say that the biggest barrier to coming and receiving dental treatment is fear. I think the saddest thing about that is that the vast majority of that fear is caused by bad experiences at the dentist. So when I then moved more into the education side, what I wanted to do is to actually make sure that those students I teach aren't going to be causing the problems and causing the dental phobias in the future.
Absolutely. And now, what is it though that... Oh, go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead. There's obviously a bit of a delay on the line, which I think is why we talked across each other.
Gotcha. I was going to say, what do you think, though, I know that obviously, you know, pain management and fear is really stopping, you know, as you mentioned, stopping people from going as often as they should. You know, but what are the best ways to kind of get over that fear? I mean, don't you just kind of jump right in?
Okay. There's a number of ways that the fear can be managed. One of the ways that we use an awful lot of the time to help people actually cope with having their dental treatment is to use a technique called sedation, which is where we actually give patients a drug. Now, that drug can be given in a variety of ways. Sometimes it's breathing gas and air, laughing gas. Sometimes it can be injected intravenously, and we tend to use, particularly in the UK, we use benzodiazepines, particularly midazolam, which goes under the trade name Dormicum in the US.
Right.
We can also use drugs which we can spritz, the same drug, midazolam, which we can get to be absorbed across the people's nasal mucosa by using it as a sort of atomized spray. Now, those techniques are really, really good for helping people to cope with having specific treatments done, get them through in a way which keeps them really, really nice and safe, doesn't put them completely to sleep, but just takes away their fears and worries and makes them to the point that they couldn't actually care what's going on around and about them. And often with these techniques as well, can kind of interfere with the patient's memory of the treatment. So it's not uncommon for patients to come out with very little memory of what's actually happened in terms of the treatment, which, you know, you talk to a lot of people and they say, hey, yeah, I'd really quite like that. You know, if I could go to the dentist, have my teeth done, come out, not remember anything about it, that would be fantastic. So that's the sort of pharmacological route that we can use. The downside of all the pharmacological routes is, of course, you're administering drugs to patients which don't wear off absolutely instantaneously. So patients usually need to have a responsible adult to look after them for the rest of the day, take a day off work, which is inconvenient for many folk. But for those who can't tolerate the dental treatment in any other way, it is obviously the best alternative. In terms with dealing with the anxieties and the phobias sort of long-term and getting rid of them, then if you're going to do that, you need to go down a route along with some of the psychological therapies, the likes of CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, which is not an area in which I have a particular expertise, but I have colleagues who will provide those therapies to help to re-educate the patient that actually the dental treatment that they were worried about, that they thought was that dreadful, actually isn't that bad. And they can then look back at the bad experiences that they've had in the past and understand what has happened to them and, if you like, relearn that, say, dentistry is easy to cope with.
And do people find or lean on a particular method more often than not?
It varies. I think that certainly in the United Kingdom, the pharmacological methods of sedation are by far more popular than the psychological interventions.
Right.
A lot of patients who we can get to the point of saying, okay, I'll come and have a checkup because I know that if you're going to do anything to me, you'll give me the sedation. But actually, if you said to me, I need a filling, I'm going to do it, and I'll just give you an injection in your gum as per normal, they would still freak out.
Mm-hmm. But, now, you know, as far as training goes...
Yeah.
I was going to say, as far as training goes, Nigel, for this, I mean, that has to be pretty serious, right? I mean, I'm sure that they do, you know, the amount of training and educational background that you have to kind of get into, that there's probably a lot involved here, right?
Yeah, I mean, we have a syllabus that's nationally recognized in the UK, and it's actually not as bad as you might think, because, of course, everyone that we're taking into the training is already a qualified dentist.
Right.
So they already have an awful lot of the basic background knowledge that they need. The syllabus was published in a set of national standards produced in Britain in April last year that I was involved in writing, although actually the syllabus in various forms has been around for, it must be almost 30 years now. The key parts of the syllabus and the training are obviously there needs to be an element of didactic training, some teaching of the basic underlying principles and the pharmacology, physiology, how the drugs work, how the patient works, and how the two relate together. But the main absolute key part of the training is that those who are going to do this have to actually treat some patients under supervision, because if you were going for treatment for anything, you would want the person who was doing your treatment to have done it before, whether that was dentistry or medicine or whatever.
Right.
So all of our potential students, if they're going to do intravenous sedation, have to actually treat 20 patients under our supervision. If they're going to do the inhalation sedation with nitrous oxide and oxygen, they have to do 10 of those patients under supervision, which means that we're working with one member of faculty supervising up to two students at a time. So it's quite labor-intensive in the training as well.
Absolutely, sure. And now, have things changed, dramatically over the course of your career, as far as practice goes when it comes to this?
When I was a student, going back to the late 70s, early 1980s, sedation was used, but it tended to be much more of a fringe activity in dentistry in the UK. It was very much a minority interest. Whereas over the time that I've been involved, now all of our undergraduate students, we have a slightly different education system here. We don't do a college degree before we go to dentistry. All of our equivalent of your pre-doctoral students will actually see some sedation as part of their pre-doctoral training. Which has meant that it's become a much more accepted part of dentistry. But going hand in hand with that, it's become a much more regulated part of the practice of dentistry. There's more being published in terms of guidelines and standards on this area of practice than anything else in the UK, which, shows the respect with which these sort of techniques are treated within dentistry. I'm not sure what it's like in the US, but certainly in the UK, in terms of the quality of the sedation that we provide, the dentists are reckoned to be far, far better than most of the medical practitioners at providing sedation. And that is down to the fact that we've had our training sorted with appropriate levels of training for many years now.
Right. Now, how long does the actual, would you say, the because I know that you just mentioned that the it's different for dentistry, obviously, in the UK than it is over here in the US. What's the time frame look like when you try to do that, for in the UK to get your, to become a dentist?
To become a dentist, it's a 5-year training course from which you enter in direct from high school. Thereafter, there is a 2-year period of what we call foundation training, which is after people are qualified as dentists, normally they will spend 1 year in a National Health Service practice and 1 year in one of the other services, either within hospital, or we have a service called the Community Dental Service, which provides access to more disadvantaged populations. So the second year would be spent in one of those areas, following which people would be then, you know, free to pursue whatever they wanted to do. Then if people want to specialise, normally specialty training is about, well, depending on the specialty and the level at which you want to practice, is another 3 to 5 years.
Hmm. And now, when you're doing this, Nigel, are you working with other doctors to kind of, you know, make sure that all bases are covered? I mean, how many different people do you work with typically in a situation or a scenario like that?
What you mean, when I'm providing sedation for a patient having
yes.
dental treatment?
Yes.
The norm would be that I would be assisted by a what we call a dental nurse, who is a person who's trained to assist us with the treatment. In order to assist with sedation, the dental nurse has to undergo some further training, which again is specified in the syllabuses that we have. And as part of her training, she would be expected to, or his or her training, they would be expected to have assisted with a similar number of cases to the ones that we would have treated. And the norm is that the same person who provides the sedation provides the dental treatment. That having been said, there will be circumstances where we'll have a separate person providing the sedation. That can be, you know, if somebody has some very, very complicated dentistry that needs done, the person who's providing the dental treatment may not want to have the added responsibility of managing the patient's sedation, may want purely to concentrate on the dentistry. So quite often I'll end up providing sedation for someone in that situation. Sometimes we can have situations where, you know, perhaps the patient is really physically quite unwell and quite frail, and I will then decide that actually I want to spend my time looking after that patient and monitoring that patient, rather than being distracted by the dental treatment. The third time that can happen is that sometimes we use some more complicated sedation techniques where we maybe have to use more than one agent, or we use agents that are given by different routes. And it may well be that when we're using some of the more complicated sedation techniques, again, we think that it's more appropriate for someone just to be concentrating on that full time. But for the vast majority of fit, healthy patients having normal dental treatment done, one dentist and one appropriately trained assistant can actually manage the patients entirely safely and effectively.
Now, as far as that goes then, Nigel, how often do you guys run into issues with, the possibility of over-medicating or, you know, over-treating a particular patient?
Very, very rarely. It all goes down to the quality of the training. There is a specific drug that's used to antagonize the sedative we use, a drug called flumazenil, and I have been teaching generations of students to do this since the early 90s, late 1990, early 1991. And I tell each year students, or each cohort of students that come through, that I have never had to open an ampule of that agent because either I or someone working under my supervision has overdosed a patient. And I'm hoping that I might be in a position to retire in about 4 years, and I keep telling them that I want to keep that record intact until I retire.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, the answer is, if it's done properly, it's very safe, and it's very, Because the way that we do it is we use a process called titration, where we just put in the drug a little bit at a time until we get the patient to the level that they need to be. And if you do that, it's incredibly safe. And as I say, we obviously teach people how to manage any potential complications, including overdose, but actually you just don't see it.
Right. And now, as far as yourself, you know, maintaining the proper knowledge and everything of all of the advancements that are made, you know, each year, I'm sure. How do you kind of stay up with everything that's going on?
Attending conferences, reading the journals. I edit a journal for a specialist society called the Society for the Advancement of Anesthesia and Dentistry. So we produce one volume per year. The great advantage of editing that is I get to see all of the papers that are submitted, whether we publish them or not. And I also subscribe to a number of library services where they send me lists of articles that they think might be relevant to what I do. So I say, yeah, that's the main way that I myself keep up to date, along with chatting to colleagues whenever I get the chance.
Absolutely, sure. Now, with the foundation of the Bristol University Open Learning for Dentistry, I was just curious about this.
Yeah.
And your role there.
Okay, the Bristol University Open Learning for Dentists was actually founded in the 90s by a predecessor working in Bristol called Derek Seal. And really it was, the idea behind it was to try and make a process whereby dentists who were qualified could learn by distance learning wherever possible. There's an organization in the UK called the Open University, which has been very successful over the years in helping mature individuals who maybe didn't go to university when they left school actually engage in academic study. And it was envisaged that this would be the same sort of idea. So my role is I direct this program, which allows students to get a postgraduate qualification. It's as flexible as it can be in that if they do three of our courses, they can end up with a qualification that is a postgraduate certificate. Six, they can get a postgraduate diploma. And then if they go on and do an MSc dissertation thereafter, they can get a master's qualification. And at the moment, we are getting to the point that in the UK, we will shortly have 1,000 dentists who possess that particular diploma qualification, which makes it the largest qualification in the UK. Now, one of the things that I'm working on and hoping to introduce for next year is I'm hoping to change the structure a little bit so that it will be more distance learning and people coming for summer schools to actually do any face-to-face contact, which will actually hopefully internationalize this qualification so we can move it beyond the boundaries of the UK. Because at the moment, students come about 6 times a year for study days or to get to or face-to-face contact, which obviously means that our captive audience tend to be people who live within about 2 hours' travel of Bristol. But I'd say what I'm hoping is if I could concentrate the study days into maybe a week in the summer where people could come and explore Bristol as well as study, but the rest of the year do everything at a distance, hopefully it might open it up to the international market. I mean, you never know, we might even get some American dentists wanting to come and study with us.
Now, and as far as the popularity of dentistry goes in the UK, I mean, do a lot of people go into the field?
Yeah, I mean, we have, the numbers are regulated by the government. They tell us how many dentists that we must produce. And they set targets based on how much disease they think is out and about and how many people they therefore think they will need to treat it. But in general, we get something in the University of Bristol anyway, we get something in the region of between 10 and 20 applicants for every place that we can offer.
And Nigel, as we're winding down to the final couple of minutes of today's show, can you just share with us some of the what you know to be the best habits to really maintain proper oral care?
Okay. The best habits are, well, moderation in all things. I don't believe that you can tell people not to have things like sugar. But the best thing to do is to actually have the sugar at meal times so that it's isolated episodes spread out during the day to let the mouth recover. Avoid extremes of lots of acid things. I know that fruit and fiber in diet is supposed to be wonderfully healthy, but many, many fruits are acidic. And again, if you eat or drink acidic things throughout the day, they will tend to erode the teeth. So again, tend to have those at meal times. Really good oral hygiene, brushing for a couple of minutes twice a day, interdental cleaning with the likes of floss about once a day. But do that before you've had the sugar or the acid. Before for the sugar so that there's no plaque on the teeth so that the bacteria in the plaque can't use the sugar. And with the acid before, because if the acid softens your teeth and then you brush them immediately after, you tend to actually make the erosion worse. And the other things, not so much for dental health, but for prevention of things like oral carcinoma, moderation in alcohol and tobacco, particularly smoking. Because alcohol and excess alcohol and excess smoking is one of the things that's known to really increase the amount of oral carcinoma that is in the population. So that's just a very quick, brief sort of potted version. But advice to anybody would be go and listen to the advice that your dentist gives you when you go for your checkup. Because they can tailor their advice on cleaning and diet to each individual's specific needs and their potential risk of disease.
Mm-hmm. And so, Nigel, now, unfortunately, we're down to the final minute or so of the show. What are some of the your favorite parts of your career?
I think the favorite part of my career, two favorite parts of my career, are seeing my really anxious patients come in, have dental treatment done, and go out really, really happy and not hating me and thinking I'm good, wonderful. And the other one is being able to inspire my students to go and do good things. And when students come up to me and tell me that something I've told them has really helped them.
Sure, absolutely. And Nigel, with a final question for you, what do you have planned for the future? I know you mentioned retirement. How soon do you, what would you do in retirement?
I said that I always wanted to be able to retire when I reach 60. Whether I will or not, I don't know. That's in 4 years. Up to retirement, I want to improve the education of dentists, particularly in terms of pain and anxiety control. And after retirement, I want to indulge my hobbies of traveling, driving fast cars, and enjoying music.
Very nice. That's the dream, right? Well,
yeah,
Nigel,
absolutely.
Thank you for coming on to the show today. We really appreciate your time, and we hope to have you back on in the near future.
Okay, pleasure to talk to you, and I hope your listeners enjoyed it.
All right, thank you again. And from everybody here at CMC Radio, this is Rob May saying we'll see you soon. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Okay, is that us off air now?